Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight we are going to be discussing the director, Todd Haynes. This is take two, following last week's technical snafu. So joining me tonight for my discussion of Todd Haynes, or for, I should say for our discussion of Todd Haynes, are Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
And Perry Seibert. Say hello.
I want to be a pop star.
Yeah, so, you know, Haynes has done a lot of movies, a lot, but also not a lot, but he's been an ever-present figure the last 30 or so years of films, and he's done a lot of different types of movies. He did a student film where he used Barbie figures to tell a story about Karen Carpenter. He has done films like Poison, Far From Heaven, and the recent May December. He is considered a major part of the American independent and new queer cinema, and as such, I think he deserves a discussion. So I will start with you, Perry. How did we first come to the work of Haynes?
I remember the buzz around Poison, and I remember being on a trip to Toronto with my family and seeing the poster at a multiplex there, and I was like, I wish I could go see this, and I couldn't while we were on this trip, but I saw Safe, and then doubled back for Poison as quickly as possible, and I have been a huge admirer and fan ever since. I'm really excited for this episode. I'm happy we're talking about Todd Haynes.
Yeah. I am going to say that my very first experience with Haynes, as it so often was or is for me, I first became aware of him from Siskel and Ebert. It was when they reviewed Velvet Goldmine. Now, I did not see Velvet Goldmine at the time. I didn't see it until much later. My first Haynes film was Far From Heaven. I then, of course, you know, saw Carol, Wonderstruck, Dark Waters, and that's been it for me for him in the theater. But that's how I came to Haynes. So what about you, Aaron? How did you first come to him?
Mr. Bob Dylan? I'm not there as the first one of his I saw. And I went because I am a Bob Dylan lover, and I left knowing that I had to track down this guy's films. I'm from the Grand Rapids area, and there was a second run theater, and for some reason at the mall, there was a second run theater at the mall. And for whatever reason, they got I'm Not There first run when no one else in the entire area had it. It was only playing in Detroit. And so I was like, hey, to a buddy of mine, and we went to see it for like $3 because, again, it's a second run theater. And so that was my introduction to Todd Haynes.
Not a bad introduction.
Not at all.
I will stick with you, Aaron, and I will ask this question. What do you think are the main themes in Haynes' films?
Theme. I think there's only one. but it's identity, and he plays with it in so many beautifully wonderful ways for the past 34 years now, 35, 36.
Yeah.
Every film comes back to the idea of identity and how we create ourselves, how we come to be, what shapes us. Even his films that are kind of more studio for hire films like Dark Waters and Wonderstruck mm-hmm. are films that really hone in on that concept, and they're of a piece with the films that originate with him. So that's really interesting as well.
Yeah, I have to say, I actually really like both of those films quite a bit. I mean, I'm not going to say either one is among necessarily his top two films, but I think they're both very, very good. I actually am really fond of Wonderstruck in a lot of ways. And, oh, gosh, the deaf girl, I just lost her name, who was also in A Quiet Place. What a debut.
Yeah, she's wonderful. Millie something, I can't remember her last name.
Mm-hmm. So, Perry, what do you feel his themes are?
I thought I was going to be the only one who loved Wonderstruck. I'm so happy. Yeah.
Yay!
I literally wrote down identity and its mutability, becoming and otherness. That's literally all I wrote for the answer to this question, because I think that just about covers it.
Yeah, that's it. I would definitely say that's it. I mean, and hey, being that's it, maybe we can blow through this episode and, you know, get done in a half hour. But no, you know, the question then becomes, how does he play with identity? And what does he do with those themes that mark him different from other directors? So that kind of will lead into some of our other questions. I'll stick with you for a moment here, Perry. How do you feel he plays with them? With those two themes you wrote down.
So what I think Haynes's great skill is that's always, like we're agreeing, that's always the theme, but it's not like he's hung up on any particular aspect of them. You know, it's not about that can make it, you know, talking about saying identity might make it sound really trite, like it's about people finding themselves, and that's not what he's doing. Sometimes it is, but that's not what he's doing all the time. He's able to, you know, to fracture this in so many different ways. It truly is a film-by-film basis, and I think it's fascinating. For me, Haynes's great skill is that he was, you know, he was a semiotics major at Brown. The dude, you know, understands signs and symbols, and that's how he comes at his films. And he's got a fabulous eye and sense of design. And so, I don't want to say at his best, but at his most accessible, which is not necessarily his best. I just mean at his most wide-ranging acceptable, like you could put anybody down in front of his movie. You know, they work like a really good family film does. You know, like, there's really good stuff that'll keep people entertained. And then for anyone who wants to watch at a deeper level and has the interest to pay attention to what he is doing, he's commenting on all of that at the same time, not undermining it, he never makes you feel dumb. He wants to explore this because he's fascinated in it, and he can share his fascination the vast majority of the time with his viewers. That's why I think I love the man. I'm going to say it repeatedly throughout the evening.
Mm-hmm. And you, Aaron?
I think that, you know, he was born in 61, so he's like a tail-end boomer, right? And he was really coming of age right as the AIDS crisis was kicking into high gear.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that the way he plays with it is that he takes these scenarios that when he was young were limited to new queer cinema or really underground stuff, and he places it into a more like middle America, for lack of a better word, context, or into a context that people who aren't necessarily coming from that background can really fully comprehend and digest. Safe in particular really caused an uprising in the gay community because they're looking at it and saying, this film is about us, but you put a straight white woman at the center of it, and why would you do that? Why would the guy who made Poison, which was just so transgressive, take this story about this very, like, small personalityless woman and put this entire story about their community on her? And it's like, because that's the Trojan horse, right? That's his in. That's how he's going to spread this story to the people who wouldn't have gone to see a movie about a black queer woman in 1995. Which, for the record, would have been most of the American box office. So putting Julianne Moore, who was, you know, not a star at that point, but she was known. She was coming off a hit there with Shortcuts, and people were starting to know that she was good. She was not necessarily a star, but she was a draw. And he was able to tell this story in his own way that really fleshed out these ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that she'd been a draw because, you know, she had done As the World Turns, and she'd done some primetime stuff, and that really did prove her to producers and directors and got her noticed to where someone like Haynes and others and Altman would come along and, you know, give her larger roles, more prominent roles. So, you know, watching the work, I do have to say this, and this is where my mind's going here, and I'm just thinking in a different direction for a moment. Has anyone maybe this is stealing something later, but has anyone in terms of a director been as important to the arc of Julianne Moore's career than Todd Haynes?
And I think it's very mutual. I would say that the other way around just as easily. So this is not a one-sided thing.
No, it's not. You know, that actually does lead into the next question that I was going to ask, and I'll ask it to you, Perry. Who is Haynes' most important collaborator?
There are four really good answers here. So I'm going to wait and see what others you all mention, but I'm going to just throw out the obvious one, and it's Christine Vachon. I don't think there's any other correct answer here. this is someone who he can trust from the beginning of every one of his ideas, as even if they're not his, even if it is something he latches on to. And boy, it is one of the great sadnesses that Christine Vachon isn't more well known outside of the film world. I know few producers are, but there's almost nobody with that in good a resume, going back all close to 40 years at this point. Killer Films put out for me two of the three best films of just this year, between May, December, and Past Lives. She's always been one of the very best. Christine Vachon is my answer, because they are combined, they are entwined. I cannot imagine his career being the same without her.
Well, you know, let's not forget that she was the one that got Haynes to do Mildred Pierce for HBO.
Yeah.
I mean, and that takes nerves of steel to touch a movie, a book that had been turned into a movie that's that iconic. hats off to her for even deciding to tackle that, which I know that adaptation has its detractors, but I quite like it. I think it's a really excellent, excellent work. She's had a hell of a career. She really, really has. So you said three of your movies this year are hers, huh?
Two of my top three.
Two of the three.
I'm going to assume that one is Haynes' newest film, and the other one I'm going to assume is Past Lives.
Past Lives is actually number one for me for the year, and May December's third.
Yep. Well, no, I was saying one of them, not the one, but those are the two. Now, Past Lives isn't my number one. Past Lives is currently sitting at number three for me, but really any of my top three could easily be my number one. I dearly love Past Lives.
That is just a
wonderful movie.
Really good.
Yeah, but you know we're getting distracted here. But hey, this is what happens. Aaron, your thoughts here?
I was really hoping I'd get to go first on this one, because that's it. I'm sorry. No, that's the only answer. Yeah, you can argue for a couple of other people, but it'd be like doing an Ang Lee show and not saying Joel Schumacher.
It's
the only answer.
It's Seamus for him. No, it's got to be her. It's got to be her. So the next question is going to be this one, and it will go to you, Aaron. And that is, what makes a Haynes film a Haynes film?
Okay. That's really hard to put into cohesive thought. So we're going to start with this big question of, you know, capital I identity with our character, right? That's always his jumping spot. Who is this character, and how are we going to unfold it? Usually her. Then we're going to funnel it through Douglas Sirk. And then we're going to throw it into the Rainer Werner Fassbender blender.
Copyright pending.
And then, copyright pending, yes. Look for my new book.
The Fast Blender.
Fassbender.
The Fast Blinder.
through all, like, he wears his influences on his sleeves. Cirque and Fassbender are always there. May, December was very heavily influenced by Altman and Berkman.
I hadn't noticed.
But they're still very much his own. You always know you're watching, like, after you've seen Todd Haynes, with that caveat.
Yeah.
You always know,
well, you
you're
know,
watching something unique to him.
Well, you know, my wife had never seen Far From Heaven until I rewatched it for this show. And then she was like, oh, this looks like – and I was like, yeah. And then she realized, you know, this is the same guy that did Carol and a few other movies. And she was like, oh, his movies are always so pretty. They always look like – and I was like an old 50s movie. And she's like, yeah. I said, well, the guy does love his Douglas Sirk. So he's got a bit of a visual aesthetic borrowed from Cirque for damn sure, you know.
He can. He doesn't have to, but he
yeah.
can do
no,
that.
No, he doesn't have
to
because
yeah.
you know, you look at something like Poison, and Poison doesn't look like a Cirque film.
It's very punk rock.
Yeah.
He's got like a punk edge to him that comes from the new queer cinema that. Obviously,
yeah.
So that's why he has to put it through the fast plunger, as Perry said, because he's got to get that punk rock in it.
Yeah. Which would be another interesting thing to see what he actually wanted to do with Velvet Goldmine before Harvey Scissorhands got
oh,
a hold of it.
Can you imagine? Probably a good film in there somewhere.
Yeah, it probably would be a good film, not just an interesting misfire, but a good film. So, you, Perry?
What makes Haynes for me is, I touched on it before, it's that ability to actually give you a narrative, and at the same time, with all of the power that comes with really great filmmaking and really not showy filmmaking on him on his behalf. He's not an ego-filled director, you know, to be able to comment on what you are seeing, not, like you said, not working against it, just letting you know this is happening in a particular time and place, and I want you to think about now also. I want you to think about yourself at the same time. Haynes is, for my money, and this is probably going to be a bit much. He's so good because of the semiotic stuff that he might be the most rewatchable filmmaker. Like every time I go back to one of the movies, I'm like, this is so good. Every time I fall back into it and I get on the train of thought that I assume he wants me on.
Well, you know, every time
so
I've seen Far From Heaven, let me interrupt you here, sorry. Every time I've seen Far From Heaven, my appreciation of it has gone up.
It was so much fun to go back and rewatch so many of these. I'm thankful we had the extra week. Because some of them I thought I knew. I hadn't gone back to Far From Heaven because I must have watched Far From Heaven a half a dozen times in the first year or two that it was out. And I hadn't watched it probably in 10. Oh, my word. No, I forgot how good this was. And I knew how good it was, but I forgot how good it was. There's
mm-hmm.
just so much going on while at the same time.
And, hey, it's a Christmas Thanksgiving movie, folks.
Oh, see, for me, that's Carol. I think Carol's the underrated Christmas film for me.
Well, you know, I'll tell you,
Carol's
the movie
totally
that's
a Christmas film.
The current stealth Christmas movie is The Holdovers, folks.
It's a good one.
Oh, it's a very good one. Very, very much so. So now I'll go back to you, Aaron, and I will ask this question. what are his influences? Beyond, we've talked about Cirque and Fassbinder, and we can talk about that in more detail, of course, but what are Haynes' influences?
I don't think we can breathe over those two. I think they're very clearly like
DNA.
Obviously,
I'm just saying, but beyond those two, and then we can go back because those are the two major ones that we're going to have to talk about.
I mentioned punk rock, and I really think that you can't downplay how important not specifically punk rock, but music, and kind of like that. Glam scene coming out of the 60s in New York was to him. He made a film titled after a David Bowie song, and then his only documentary ever has been about Velvet Underground. That he also made the definitive Bob Dylan movie when there are several that are up for, you know, that title. So music very much influences his thought process and his ideas.
Yep.
But also, like, just his contemporaries.
Mm-hmm.
The guys and the men and women coming up with him through New Queer Cinema. Can you imagine Todd Haynes or Gus Van Sant, either of them, really coming up in a vacuum without the other one? I think that
no.
Haynes has certainly at this point surpassed Van Sant. But their early work is so symbiotic.
Yeah. Well, you know, you look at
like
something like Poison and you look at something like Gas, Food, Lodging, and absolutely.
So, I like, the whole movement was very much academic in the sense that all of the films were in dialogue and in Congress with each other. And I can't see any of the filmmakers that came out of that movement succeeding without any of the others being there too. I can't see Poison without Drugstore Cowboy, and I can't see My Private Idaho without Poison. You know,
yeah.
And they just constantly are building each other up.
Man, you know, you know, you're reminding me of how good Van Sant used to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that he's bad now. It's just that
he
used to take risks and tell more personal stories. And I wish he'd get back to that because, you know, that was when his films were consistently interesting. So, Perry, you?
I'm going to go, and I don't think this is just the because they share the same sexual orientation. I don't discount Almodovar helping to show him the way. Because, you know, Almodovar's 80s works are right there for him to discover and grow up with as he's figuring this out, and they share that ability to use a very specific older cinematic language, but to make it very modern and very up to the moment to get you to think about identity and to think about and also the entire punk rock thing. I mean, that is I think that's where I feel it most strongly from with him.
I kind of skipped him because he, for me, was kind of coming from the Cirque Fassbinder angle as well. But yeah,
Cirque
films are very much akin.
And I want to be clear, I don't think he's copying
right.
Almodovar at all. I think it's an example.
They share
okay.
influences, though.
Absolutely. The difference being that, you know, one is coming out of, you know, one goes into their 20s in a state where everything that they are is being thought of as frightening and causing death, and the other one is hitting that stride just when everything opens up and is free. I guess that's
right,
the difference
exactly.
between the two, right?
Yeah. So, you know, now we can talk a little bit about, you know, those other influences, Cirque and Fassbinder. So let's have at it. If you had to choose, like, let's start it this way. If you had to choose one as having perhaps more or greater influence, who would you choose? Perry?
Okay, well, Cirque, only because Fassbinder doesn't do what he does without Cirque. So it, to me, it's a progression. Like, I don't, I mm-hmm. he's, you know, we could think of Haynes as the grandson in this situation. I just think that's the better way to look at it, and I like it that way because I there are many Fassbinder films I love, but I greatly prefer Haynes on the whole to Fassbinder in almost every imaginable way. And that's all good. And the fact is that he's an American filmmaker, so he's going to lean towards Cirque instead of Fassbinder quite directly. Absolutely, the punk rock thing is there. Absolutely, the you can do this on your own thing. I'm so glad he doesn't feel the need to make 18 movies a year. That's great. Take your time. You're a thinker. I'm glad. Think. Then make your movie. So that's where I land with that. Cirque is the way. You don't need to have seen a Fassbinder film to appreciate what Haynes does. You need to have seen a Cirque film or two to understand what he's doing.
Yeah, to really get it.
Or to at least appreciate it in the way he intends it to be appreciated. You could still really get it and love it. But if you want to go that next level, yeah, you need to have seen some Cirque.
Just a bit. One or two or three or four. Aaron?
First of all, I'm going to say that I disagree with the last point because I think that seeing Fassbinder also is going to deepen your appreciation for what he's doing. In the same way that Cirque does. And
particularly something like Fear Eats the Soul.
Yeah, or The Marriage of Maria Braun. Veronica Voss, or, you know. The other thing I was going to say is I actually 100% agree with Perry's reasoning with the opposite result. I would say Fassbinder is more influential because he's closer and because he's further filtering through him. So he is closer to the end result than the starting process. But it's the same thought process that got us there. I do appreciate the Americanness, though I would point out that Cirque is also in German. One of the great, you know, German filmmakers that we never got to have that great German sound era because of Hitler. They all came to America. Anyway.
And that's why Hollywood did not stink in the 30s and 40s, yo.
True.
Thank you, Hitler? Question mark.
Lubitsch and Lubitsch and Wilder alone, not to mention the many dozens of others.
I can't now. I have to work. I'm talking to myself, not the kids.
Thank you, Hitler, for the kids. I get it. That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Hitler, for the kids. Listen, I don't think there's a wrong answer here. I did have the same reasoning to the different to the opposite result as Perry, which I found amusing. But
well,
I really don't. I don't think there's a wrong answer
Pathfinder.
Here. So.
To Cirque, so
I do too, as far as like just personal taste goes. But as far as like answering this question for Haynes, I don't think there's you can't answer it incorrectly, as long as you
yeah.
recognize that those two are like the monumental influences.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Because
so now,
also, sorry. He also has the queer angle to it, which Cirque does, but it's so drenched in 1950s subtext that it can be difficult for some modern audiences to suss out.
Yeah,
where Fox
yeah.
and His Friends is very obvious.
And this kind of ties in, we've touched on it a little bit already, but I'll go back to you, Aaron. Who has Haynes influenced?
Mm-hmm. I think that question's a, we run into this every time we talk about a newer filmmaker. Because it's hard to break away a newer artist from what they're being influenced by specifically. So I'm going to cop out, and I'm going to say Kelly Reichert, who he is not influenced on an artistic level, but on a personal and patronage level.
yeah, I would say that there's a certain operational ethos in common.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you like that? the way they've worked outside the system.
She was also an actress in Poison, so.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So, Perry?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we've covered all the answers here, right? It's, yeah, it's kind of obviously Kelly Reichert, and agreed. There are, I mean, you could draw similarities, but it's not, yeah, she's not slavishly trying to recreate Todd Haynes' cinematic universe. And as we've talked about before when this question comes up, all of these, you know, a really great indie director does nothing but inspire other indie directors to remain independent directors. This is, you know, this goes back to Cassavetes, right? Scorsese wasn't doing what Cassavetes did, but there's no Scorsese
he was doing it how
Cassavetes
he did it.
Films. And at the same time, let's not discount what we were saying earlier. His influence was immediate within that group of peer directors, right? And they're,
yes,
I agree
absolutely.
That they absolutely were commenting on each other and influencing each other. So he was influencing in real time.
Yeah. So well, this then you'll like this next question. Where does he fit among other directors of the new queer cinema?
For me?
Perry, you're going to get this question.
I'm gonna give this to you two ways. I don't think there's anybody better, and I think that's an incredibly limiting question. I think he's one of the 10 best living American filmmakers. I feel like this is unfair. I think he is.
Oh no, don't misunderstand the question. I'm not trying to pigeonhole him as just that, but among that group. Where do you place him? And then obviously, you know, in general.
Sure. No, but it's the obvious. That's how highly I rate him in that group. I don't have anybody else in that group in my 10 greatest living filmmakers list. So, I guess that about covers it right there.
So, Aaron, you?
I tend to agree. I do think that Gus Van Sant is incredibly important as well. I don't like him as well as I like Haynes, but I think that within the movement, he's right up there. And I also adore Cheryl Dunier, who came kind of at the tail end of the movement with Watermelon Woman.
That's such a wonderful movie.
It really is. But she's kind of like, she's part of it, but some like on her own too. And like, I don't want to get into intersexuality or intersectionality. Sorry. Right now, but she's kind of like, she's part of it, but she's totally not part of it at the same time. And, you know, but I agree also with Perry that I think he transcends that early moment. Because he kind of moves away from it too. Like, he deals with queer themes throughout his films. Do not get me wrong. But that really punk rock, transgressive stuff of the specific new queer movement, he went away from pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Poison was 100% a new queer cinema film. You can argue that Safe was. It's a little less transgressive, but you can argue that that's like tail end of the movement. But then he was done. That's two films, and he's walking away, or at least, you know, broadening his net a little bit. But, man, I think he's more akin in some ways to the indie crowd of the late 80s and early 90s. And if you start talking about, you know, Spike or Soderbergh or the Andersons or, you know, that group, then you're getting into like, yeah, this is the crowd that like he's maybe a little more in tune with for most of his career. The guys that for, you know, got Weinstein at some point in their career. He's a titan, though. He's a incredible filmmaker, and he is one of the great living American filmmakers. He might not quite be in my top 10, but he's close.
Mm-hmm. And now we come to to this part of the show, and you'll get this question, Aaron. What's his worst film for you?
Is this a question?
That doesn't mean that it's a bad film.
I'm not even sure it needs to be addressed. It is bad. But it's so bad that there's only one answer, and it's Velvet Goldmine. And I don't blame him for it being bad, but it is bad, and there's no getting around it. I went into it knowing that it had been butchered, and I went in just hoping I could find the kernel of Haynes inside of it. And then I remember the Peter Biskind book, Down and Dirty Pictures, and his interview with Christine Vichen about the way that Haynes wept for days after he saw what Harvey Weinstein had done to his film. And Like, how can you blame, like, I can't blame him for that. Like,
yeah.
He
no, it's one of the legendary butcherings of a film. I mean, it's one of the legendary butcherings of the film. It's right up there with what the Ladd Company did, damn near killing Sergio Leone by tearing apart Once Upon a Time in America. I mean, it's that big a butchering.
Yeah.
So, Perry, your choice?
Yeah, that's the answer. But I have to say, this was – so I remember being horribly let down by Velvet Goldmine in the theater, and I had never gone back to it. But I went back to it for this show. I literally hadn't seen it since the theater.
I'm sorry.
What, 25 years? And you know what? It's not as bad as I remember it. I'm not saying it's good, and it certainly doesn't work. It's the only one of his films that doesn't work. And that
it lacks a certain propulsive energy that his films usually have.
Well, it's not even that. It doesn't. It is. I don't want to say he, but I can't help it. He still got his name on the film. He took it. It doesn't. It asks for too much of a narrative that it doesn't deliver on. It's either a refracted look at Citizen Kane, or it's about David Bowie and the glam movement. Those two things don't reconcile in the movie at all.
And don't forget the fairy tale.
Right, and it doesn't need the narrative, which is why it's really interesting to me. And part of this is I've always wondered, I don't love that era of rock. I like a lot of it, but I am not hung up on Bowie and Iggy Pop and the
right.
Reed in that era and everything. So I know what he's doing. I know the history. I understand what's happening, but it doesn't hit me because I don't connect to it. And I know that that's partly me because I also love Dylan, and I adore there, which just
yep.
throws out narrative altogether and works
it's gone.
Beautifully.
It's gone.
Right. So I don't want to... It's not as bad as I remember it. Oh boy, does that sound like an incredible backhand compliment? But it probably is. But I don't think of it as a disaster in my head after revisiting it. I understand why I don't like it, and I think I can say objectively it doesn't work. But oh, I can see what's in it now, and I couldn't before.
And now we come to the fun part. And now we come to the fun part, and we're going to do it Siskel and Ebert style, where we list our four films, because we're going to do four films, our top four films. So we'll all start with our four, move on to our three, then our two, then our one. And we'll start with you, Perry. So what is your number four, Haynes?
Okay. I'm going to caveat the shit out of this. These are definitely my top four for him. I cannot land on an order for the life of me. I didn't have one when we were set to record this last week. I've been thinking about it for a week, and I still can't. I have no idea how to rank these against each other, so I have no idea what's going to come out. I'm just going to pick one each time. I have no idea here is what I am confessing to you. Please don't hold me to this. I am not saying one is better than four. So I guess I'm just going to start with the one we've mentioned the most, which is Far From Heaven, which is the absolute perfect reworking of Cirque. I really like your point earlier, Aaron, that he sort of leaves the new queer cinema behind after the first two films. But, you know, Velvet Goldmine and Far From Heaven really still have their at least one foot firmly in it.
I thought
you were absolutely right, and then I thought, it's still there. He hasn't quite left it, and it made me think.
Still there in Carol, right? He still flirts with it. Like his scenes are still very queer. It's just that like he's not going for that, you know, the Sex Pistols, Flippy of the Bird, yeah. transgressive stuff that was in Poison.
Yeah, he's not, he doesn't want to be in your face. He wants to be in your head, and he gets there
right.
every time. And Far From Heaven is an absolute, you know, it is masterful. even like I said, revisiting it again for the first time in a decade, I just marvel. I can't remember the last time. I can remember in the last 30 years, maybe twice, being genuinely surprised and shocked and hurt and feel it was a moment of violence when somebody drops an F-bomb. And that's one of the two. That's how good that film is. That scene, and that's almost like if you ask me to dig up the one scene that represents everything that he does well, it might be that scene on the steps coming out of the first visitation with the doctor. Like that is, he has perfectly recreated Cirque, and he has put you in a situation where he can use modern language to fracture that for you. And it will play even if you've never seen any of those Cirque films. And it will probably play just as shockingly in part thanks to that spectacular Elmer Bernstein score. It's Far From Heaven. That's where I'm landing on first. I refuse to call it fourth. I'm going to say that's where I'm landing first tonight.
Yep. So my number four is Safe. You know, very interesting film. And hey, look, Julianne Moore. I mean, why not? You know, we touched on it earlier, but yeah, that's my number four. So what about you, Aaron? What's your number four?
It's been a while since I've cheated, so I'm going to take a tie. And I'm going to say Safe and I'm Not There. Which in some ways may be two of his more interesting films, just like with everything that's going on. Safe is trying to do a lot, and it's packing in so many ideas and themes into a really tight package. And I'm Not There is trying to be everything at the same time. It's a Bob Dylan song that's 2.5 hours long, and it hits every note. And when Richard Gere comes out in that psychedelic colored cabin, man, it's just, oh, what a great film. So, yeah.
So, number three. Perry?
I spin the wheel and it lands on Safe. Let's talk about Safe now. Yes, sign on to everything you've both said, and I will one-up it by saying I don't know that he leaves you with anything. He just keeps looking at it. Like, there's not a point. There's not a payoff. There's not a, I'm telling you this.
That kind of
is
the point is keep right. looking, keep questioning.
It is an exercise in complete and total dis-ease. Not disease, dis-ease. It is such an off-putting, watchable movie. I every time I go back to it, I'm like, I don't understand what's
my
happening.
My wife had the same reaction.
She
was like, I can't do this. I was like, what do you mean? She said, I can't watch this movie. It's bothering me.
Yes.
I watched the Julianne Moore interview with Todd Haynes that Criterion put on the Safe Blu-ray disc. And she was talking about how, like, she tried to not project her voice at all. Like, it was all vocal cords. Like, she was not pushing air through her diaphragm. that she was trying to be as weightless as she could possibly be and take up as little space as she could. And, like, that's it. Like, you're right. There's nothing there because there's no woman there. We're looking at one, but she's not there. She's the opposite of Bob Dylan, right? She
right.
isn't there. Or she is Bob Dylan. She's also not there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, my number three, it's going to make you smile, Perry. My number three is Wonderstruck.
Oh, yay.
Which totally took me by surprise when I saw it when it was new. And had many scenes that just had my jaw slightly agape that it was like, wow, this is like really fucking emotionally resonant shit. Holy hell. I mean, it's based on a Selznick book. I cannot say his name today. I'm going to, yep. Selznick, the guy that did Hugo
Very
Cabaret.
David O. Selznick's grandson.
Mm-hmm,
yep.
Mm-hmm. And let's put it this way. I wish we'd get more great filmmakers making films out of his books, because then we'd have a lot more good movies.
There's only the two or three books. So two of them
I thought he had done four books altogether.
Maybe. I was thinking there were two or three.
Yep, I was thinking there were four books. But no, this one, you know, it's both so unlike what Haynes has done, and yet absolutely in line with it.
Well,
because
it's
about
Haynes,
who you are and who you're becoming.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what was your number three, Aaron?
He just made another masterpiece. May December is my number three. As his search for identity led him, his search for identity and also his love of cinema finally led him to the place where he was bound to end up at some point, right? Where do actors go when they're doing actorly things? Are they real people? And how do they treat real people? And how do real people treat them? And what happens when there's a monster living in a small southern town who thinks that she's just the nicest person in the world? You get me a Bergman, right? Like, you bring a Bergman to the party, I'm there. But it's not just Bergman in the way that some recent films have been. It's really trying to get under the skin and to the idea of what's causing these personality shifts. There is indictments on acting. There are indictments on society. On heteronormalism, on feminism.
Yeah.
No one is safe in this film. and it's just wonderful.
No, it's solid. I don't love it as much as you do, but yes. So Perry, number two, spin the wheel and
number
tell us what pops out.
Before we get to that, I want to go back to Wonderstruck for just a second, and
mm-hmm.
say that a couple of superlatives for that film for me. Is there a more cinematic film aimed at kids since Black Beauty, Black Stallion, I mean, right? Or it's like 40 years since there's been a truly cinematic film aimed at kids. And that film will play for kids.
What about Hugo?
I think Hugo is a film about art, and I think Wonderstruck is an art film. I think there's a difference. And I'm not saying one is better than the other. But
yeah,
you know,
Hugo's, you know, it's interesting you said it's a film about art.
Hugo is.
Hugo is one of those films, and Aaron and I were talking about this the other day, because of Maestro coming out, and Maestro is not necessarily about the creation of art, although that's part of it. But we were trying to think of how few films there were that are about the creation of art, and how even fewer of those are any good. Hugo is one of them. Love and Mercy is another. You know, there aren't many that work because it's such a hard thing to capture. I think Wonderstruck.
That's an internal.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because Wonderstruck, I think, really does ride that line. But yeah, it is an art film. So please go on.
But my number two, my number two is Carol, which I would not have thought was going to be that high. Before we started doing this, and it was the revisit that floored me. I was trying to figure out the word that I had for it, like 90 minutes in, and I realized, oh, this film is immaculate. I don't know that I've ever described the film as immaculate. It is without blemish. I'm not saying it's perfect. I am saying that as much as we all agree that Christine Vachon is number one, Ed Lachman and Sandy Powell, one of the greatest living cinematographers and the greatest living costume designer, are perfectly suited to work with Haynes. He's got the taste to understand what they can both do. And they have both worked for him numerous times. And this film is just, it's so lush. It's so just physically beautiful. And the two performances at the center of it are absolutely, you know, they're both there.
It just missed my top four. I actually have to say that the reason it did miss that my top four is as gorgeous as it is. I just didn't feel the deep connection of the two characters as much as others did. But like I said, that's just me, you know. But it's a very fine film, no, regardless. So my number two is Poison. Why not? You know, one of the great debuts. Very angry, very powerful film that has lost little of its potency over the years. Easily one of the best of that decade. Truly monumental work in a lot of ways. So, Aaron, you're number two?
Far From Heaven. Just, what can I say? That hasn't already been said twice. It's an absolutely gorgeous film. It's so good that not even Dennis Quaid could get in its way, which he tends to do.
He was pretty good in there.
It's magnificent. It's a really great film.
No, it is. I mean, what else is there to say? So, Perry, push the button and find out what pops out finally. You're number one.
May, December. I am... I I realized going through this, I think I might have been criminally undervaluing Haynes' films when I make my year-end list, because I don't think, with the exception of Safe, I've ever had another one in my top three. And I'm like, how did I not? How? What did? How? I'm bad. I need to be better at this. May-December gutted me like nothing all year. The last scene of May-December is just, I felt hollow.
It's soul-crushing.
It's soul-crushing. And the fact that he gets you to, it's the fact that he gets you to vacillate your feelings about everybody through the whole runtime until that ending where you go, oh, no, this is what you've been watching all along. If you were paying attention, you'd know that. And I cannot wait to watch it a second time. I haven't yet. I don't know why.
It's like,
so
oh no,
good.
these are awful people and a victim.
Yes. Yeah, and it's like, wow. And yes, Aaron, what you're saying, absolutely. I don't know that it is a little bit an indictment of acting, and but I think it's more an indictment of celebrity and the different ways celebrity is attained.
Yeah,
there's
absolutely.
Definitely commentary on acting, absolutely. But I think that might trump it just a little in the ideas that Haynes is playing with here. And boy, yeah. Can I take a second to praise my favorite single theme performance of the year? And I mean that from like a truly, not someone who would even qualify for a supporting actor Oscar, just like a one scene where you come in and you breathe life into something in a way that, not that it hadn't been lively before, but you're like, what is this? What is happening
this
here?
This is why
is
I said
kid?
We need to have a featured performer category at the Oscars.
I have to look. I've forgotten it, and I shame on me. I have to remember the name of the kid who plays the oldest son. The scene where
we see
him and the band. He's fighting with the band while talking with Natalie Portman's character. He is just electric. I am so in. And that's not – like, that scene is – it's just one in the movie. May-December is so good, people. Netflix, I wish Netflix didn't have this movie. I wish it could have played in theaters for a real long time. It's so good. It's so good. And again, it is what I've been talking about with Haynes. It works as a narrative beautifully. And look closer. There's a whole lot more stuff going on. If you pay attention to it, it's so good.
Well, you know, for me, my number one is Fire from Heaven. It's been my number one of his work for a long time, and my recent revisit only confirmed it. And is there anything that I can really add to what we've said? No, not really. So I will let Aaron tell us about his number one, which I'm sure is Dark Waters.
It absolutely is. Mark Ruffalo was really good. I had nothing planned there because my number one is Carol. Perry wouldn't say it. I will. It's a perfect movie. Beyond that, it's perfect. Like, I can't critique it. There's nothing I can say to add to the discussion. Mara Rooney, to me, gets really undersold here because everybody loves Kate Blanchett because she's Kate Blanchett. That whenever... like, she has a scene partner, they kind of get swallowed up in any discussion that might happen surrounding the film. And that's no disrespect to Kate Blanchett. It's just facts. it happens in I'm Not There.
Nature.
In I'm Not There, there are 100 actors who play Bob Dylan perfectly, but we all talk about Kate Blanchett. As he should.
Ben Whishaw's right with her. I think Ben Whishaw's right with her, but yes, I agree with you.
So Rooney Mara, I think, is just incredible in Carol. She's kind of playing with that idea of not being there, too. She's a little more there than Julianne Moore in Safe. but she's definitely a wallflower. She definitely likes to hide in the corner of the party. It looks immaculate, to use Perry's word. The Tricia Highsmith novel that it's based on is just perfect fodder for Todd Haynes.
Could you imagine a Todd Haynes version of Talented Mr. Ripley?
God.
And I'm actually one that doesn't hate the Minghella.
I love it.
Well, there's also the Vendors version, right? So we're getting a lot of Talented Mr. Ripley's now. But I'd watch it. I'd so watch it. That goes without saying at this point. Wonderful, wonderful stuff.
At the risk of sounding incredibly sappy, one of the reasons I really love it is that ending, because it's the one you don't expect, and it is utterly earned. I love the fact, I mean, you know, it's real easy, like, say, in Poison, to, you know, to end this really badly and horrifically, and that would fit for someone who came of age in the AIDS crisis. But
right.
To set that film in that time period and to give them that ending, that's true maturity. It's not a sop to the marketplace. It's not, I want a happy ending. That feels really real. Like she goes back to that party, the Carrie Brownstein scene, right? And then realizes this isn't where I want to be. This is where I want to be. We're back to being an identity, aren't we? It's so good. It's so wonderful.
And it hurts. It hurts so good.
Yeah.
It really, really. No, like I said, it's not my favorite Haynes. It's just outside the top, but it's very good. It's very good. So now we're going to come to housekeeping, and housekeeping, unfortunately, there's not a lot to say. Carl is doing a show on Sunday, taking up the mantle of the departed TC, who is no longer with us, unfortunately. Carl's going to continue to do music shows in honor of TC. And his next one is going to be on Sunday, as long as the gods of blog talk allow it. However, this show will be back. I know we've had a bit of an irregular schedule lately, folks, and that's been due, obviously, to the technical problems that we've experienced lately. So hopefully we won't have that anymore, though you never know. And as such, I do want to say we will be back next week with a very short show, I expect, very short, under an hour, probably under 45 minutes, where we are going to pick our favorite films and TV series that we've watched over the past year, and also perhaps a little discussion of some of the people who have passed away recently, I do want to give a moment to, because we weren't able to do this last week, but the loss of Andre Brouwer, who, you know, of course, people know him from Homicide: Life on the Street, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and films like Glory. But, you know, what an actor, and only 61 years old. So, you know, that's a loss for the acting world. And I did want to give a moment to that. And so we'll get into things like that next week. But, you know, both of you guys are invited if you want to come in next week on the 29th for that show. Our next show after that will be January 12th, and our topic of discussion on the 12th of January is going to be an HBO series by the name of Rome. If you haven't seen it, that's not unexpected. It only lasted 2 seasons, and it was the most expensive series the BBC had ever produced, because they were the co-producer on it, and it's since surpassed by other series. But, yeah, and part of the reason that show got canceled was because of how damn expensive it was, and HBO wasn't about to foot the bill without help. And we'll get into that in about 3 weeks. And then 2 weeks after that, on the 26th, we will have a look at the director Andrei Tarkovsky. So that's what's coming up over the next month or so on Cathode Ray Mission. And now I'm going to ask the question I always ask. Is there anything that we haven't brought up about Haynes that you'd like to bring up really quick before we say goodnight? So I'll go with you first, Perry.
Dark Waters is good. I
know. Oh, it is.
Talk about it, because it's the least sort of fascinating one, but it is, again, doing I mean, it feels like an Oscar bait liberal do-gooder, you know, issue movie, and it is that. But he goes a different way with how he's doing it. It's really worth checking out. I don't even want to talk about how, because it really is a good movie worth seeing. I don't want to spoil some of the stuff he does in that movie. And I do want to say, because we really haven't talked about it in detail, and I know it's hard to find. It shows up on YouTube every once in a while before it gets taken down. If you have not seen Superstar, if you have not seen his Karen Carpenter Barbie doll movie, it's outstanding.
Don't get it confused with the other Barbie doll movie.
It is... It sounds like such a gimmick. It sounds like a rock and roll punk gay cinema thing to do, and it's not. I mean, it is, but it's not.
Well, I would say it is and it isn't.
It's a really moving piece. It's really effective. And I was lucky enough to actually see it. A friend was curating an underground films night at Eastern Michigan sometime in the it had to have been the early 2000s, and it was the first time I saw both that and The Big Shave, the Scorsese short, and it was wow. Superstar is really excellent. Please check it out if you've never seen it.
You mean you wandered from Ann Arbor to Ypsilanti? Oh my God,
you
went into enemy territory. did it smell like farts over there?
No, they do. No, because Dom's Donuts is there. It smells like Dom's.
Oh, that's right. Now I actually don't mind it. See, I just have to tease because, you know.
Of course.
nothing wrong with that place. Good town. But Aaron, anything you want to bring up real quick?
Mine is also about Dark Water, strangely enough. Did you know that DuPont's stock dropped over 7 points over the weekend that Dark Waters came out?
I did not.
It is not just, like, that's a statement. Like, and maybe, yeah, that speaks to the liberal finger-wagging do-gooder message movie point of it. But it also speaks to the quality of it because,
yeah,
like, that doesn't actually happen after a movie plays. Like, there were real-world consequences to the people that this movie was about.
Yep.
And I think that's because, as Perry said, it's a movie that wasn't just that. It was that, but it was about people. And how
and
the
people
were truly affected.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, you know, honestly, this is, you're going to laugh. If you guys hadn't mentioned Dark Waters, I was going to mention it as the hidden gem, and please go see it. So I think that speaks to it. So I will just say that, yeah, folks, see Dark Waters. Don't miss it. It's a good one. So, you know, I think that pretty much wraps this one up. So I want to, as always, thank you guys for coming in and participating. Thank everybody else out there for listening and bearing with us over the last month of technical issues and delays. And, yep, we're still here, still doing this. So thank you for listening. Thank you for participating. And on the count of three, we will say good night. One, two, three, good night.
Good night.